You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This is the CRM Archaeology Podcast. It's the show where we pull back the veil of cultural resources management, archaeology, and discuss the issues that everyone is concerned about. Welcome to the podcast.
Welcome to CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 311. And today joining me is Bill in Northern California.
Good morning.
And Andrew in Southern California.
Hey, everybody. What's up?
So, you know, we started this conversation with Doug, who's in Scotland, but not joining us today, in our previous podcast, episode 310. It was titled The Potential Future of Vocational Training and Technical Workforce in CRM. This was something that actually was Bill's idea. So for those that didn't hear episode 310, go take a listen. We talked a little bit about avocational archaeology and vocational archaeology with the idea that Bill was then going to, he has a real passion about the subject. And so we stayed away from what we knew Bill wanted to focus on. But so Bill, I'm going to let you go ahead and take it away. And then we'll come back to how this connects to our first episode 310.
Yeah, I don't know if passion is more now, since I work for a university, my livelihood depends on knowing this kind of stuff. So
yeah. I'm
put in a corner where I got to learn to survive. That's a good place to be. At the SAA, I wasn't able to attend in person, but I was part of a forum that was recruiting people to talk about professional skills and training as part of the Airlie House 2.0 program. I don't know if folks know about it, but the Airlie House reports were written about 50 years ago, and they really charted the direction of the National Park Service archaeological program. And there was a lot of things that were decided back then that we carried forward, like standardized site forms across sites, consultation with Native American groups. Like, those were things that were talked about in the original Airlie House reports. But it's been brought to our attention that the NPS hadn't revisited those in 50 years. Like, we were just using that stuff, but not really using it to further archaeology. And this is important because the National Register of Historic Places is managed by the National Park Service, the keeper of the National Register. They work for the National Park Service. And so the archaeology survey and, you know, the directions of how things should go in archaeology, the NPS plays a really big role in our country. So the Airlie House 2.0 was a project to have folks that are part of tribes, that are part of universities, CRM companies, museums, all come together to talk about what we see as the future and how we can handle things. And I'm fortunate enough, I've been part of it since the beginning, but I've really been part of the group that's talking about professional skills and training. And I gave a talk while I recorded it, and it was part of my forum, and we had a great conversation. And we've got an action group that's being developed as part of an SAA subcommittee. So if folks are interested in SAA members, check it out. It's coming out now. But my talk was 10 minutes, and it was focused on like the inflection point, basically, that we're facing now in archaeology in the United States when it comes to preparing the next generation of American archaeologists. So this podcast has been going on for almost 10 years. Has it been going? I don't know. I think maybe it has been going on for 10 years.
Yeah, I think it is 10 years.
Yeah. Okay. So in the last 10 years, there's a lot of stuff that's changed. And one of the big changes is in 2022, we got a huge package of funding from the federal government to do all kinds of different infrastructure projects. And that is going to lead to a couple billion more dollars spent on cultural resources in the United States. It's Jeff Altschul and Terry Klein in 2022 wrote an article that's in, it's in Archaeological Practice, which is Advances to Archaeological Practice. But it talks about this increase and the potential that there's going to be possibly 11,000 new FTEs created between 2022 and 2031 that include 8,000 new archaeologists. So that was based on their estimates. Now, other people have questioned it and said, will that turn into actual FTEs? We don't actually, in fact, know, but we do know that given retirements and just overall attrition in archaeology, there will be thousands of archaeology jobs that could be funded in the next year. But the problem is universities, they only graduate about 297 master's and PhD folks across the country every year. So there's not going to be people with those graduate degrees that meet the qualifications of the Secretary of Interior to meet those thousands of new jobs. That also seems good if you're getting into archaeology, because there's a time when we have more funding and there's possibly more jobs and there's going to be things that are going on all over the country, and we're not graduating enough people. That means that folks with bachelors, that they're going to end up doing jobs that otherwise would have been done by master's folks, right? So the outlook looks rosy, and then that runs into what we're talking about. How do we train all these people for jobs? Because once again, universities are the place where folks are getting trained. Of all the institutions across the country, really most of the folks are getting their experience and first introduction to archaeology through universities. And then, of course, like I said, as far as professional certifications, college degrees are like a huge part of how you prove that you're a professional in the United States. So this whole podcast for a decade has been talking about how in the hell do universities actually produce the kind of people that can work in cultural resources? Because it's pretty clear that's not necessarily happening. And last week we talked about the possibility of volunteers and avocationals helping out. I also agree that's a good idea. However, are we really going to find 8,000 more people? That I don't know if we're going to find all those folks, right? So what are we going to do? The thing that makes it even more complicated is demographic information, and also just information about universities in general across the United States. I put a link to a report that was written by this organization called the Western Interstate Commission for Higher Education, and they wrote a report in 2024 called Knocking at the College Door: Projections of High School Graduates. And so they're just looking at the demographic information in the United States, and what they've put together as far as their report, which I, folks in the United States should really click on it. The overall numbers of Americans between 18 and I can't remember, 24, I think is the age that they're calling the college age, is going to go down by 2025 or 2040. So over the next 20 years, we can expect to see a drop across all ethnicities and all racial groups in the number of high school graduates. Now, we know that most people in the United States, they go on to college right after high school or soon after high school, a few years after high school. And those are the folks that we could potentially train to be archaeologists. Now, there's a lot in the report. I think that folks should look at it. One of the things that's critical is that this enrollment decrease is not going to be steady across the United States. So some places like the state of California, they project a 29% decrease in high school graduates over the next 20 years. And already, as someone who lives in California and has two kids in secondary school, I can literally see it happening right in front of my face. This isn't just the pandemic. This is just the reality of living in California. Tons of people who have kids are leaving the state. And in here in the Bay Area, schools are closing. They're laying off a bunch of people that were hired with funding partially that came from the pandemic, but also just the fact that we had more kids. So a lot of the like classroom aides, a lot of the office assistants, a lot of those folks are getting laid off. And even in fact, they're laying off teachers here in the Bay Area because there's just not enough students, right? Now, in other places like Texas, Idaho, there's projected to be an increase in the number of high school aged folks. And in general, across the southeastern United States, they project an increase of high school aged students. But everywhere else, including the American West, is supposed to have a decrease in college aged students. Now, in higher ed, we call this the enrollment cliff, and 2025 represents the year right now in May is the most high school graduates that we can expect to see pretty much in our lifetime. Now, that's going to cause a lot of knock-on effects, right, with universities, because interestingly, while the state of California is projected to lose enrollments, the place where I work, one of the university UCs, is actually increasing its enrollments. And it's really doing so by bringing on a lot of students that would have otherwise gone to California state schools. So I don't know if folks understand that not only is California the most populous state, it's the most ridiculous state when it comes to higher education as far as having the most number of campuses. And they actually have a two-tiered system where there's 10 University of California scattered across the state with a supporting level of, I think, 23 Cal State campuses and then dozens and dozens of community colleges.
Community colleges, I think it's 111.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah. So we're talking like hundreds of schools in one state that only has 39 million residents and is about to lose 30% of its high school graduates. So you can imagine what's going on. The University of California's, which are the flagship institutions, are basically just enrolling more and more students that would have otherwise gone to community college and the state schools. You know, there's a prestige thing going on where folks who go to UCLA think that they're going to a place with more prestige because of the rankings that, interestingly, places like UCLA and Berkeley create and pay the College Board to rank us higher. But anyway, so that's the whole thing. But also, just in general, the state is putting more money and there's more grant money and effort into those top 10 schools than they're putting into the smaller ones. At the Cal State level, which otherwise would have had a lot of training, like archaeology field methods, great field schools, there would have been incentive and space for professors to teach field programs. Those are the schools that are struggling and are having troubles getting enrollments. And then the other elephant in the room that's about to just explode like an atom bomb is the way that the federal government has been monkeying around with grant money, right? So it's not clear whether it's against the law to withhold federal grant money. It's not clear whether there should be a limit on how much overhead universities are paying on this grant money. That's all being adjudicated right now in courts. But at the end of the day, checks aren't coming from DC. And you can be sure that universities are not going to decide to pay me less or to get rid of administrators who make $500,000 for a bunch of Zoom meetings and giving out awards. They're going to think about doing things like cutting whole programs, having less staff, using AI to do stuff that otherwise should be done by a human, and jack up tuition. So students that are living in everywhere in the United States are watching tuition climb because there's no limit. There's no cap on how much student loans you can borrow. And they're talking about having some kind of federal cap. That's dumb because Chase Manhattan Bank is just going to allow you to borrow even more. There's nothing to keep anything leveling off as far as tuition, except for states and the federal government actually taking control of how much the universities are costing, which, once again, the university is just like any other business. It's got a lot of different stuff going on and it's trying to raise revenue, right? Students these days are really thinking about, where can I get the degree that's going to give me the most money. Now, there is a foolish misconception that the minute you get the degree, you just march over to Google and they just give you $250,000 like right away, right? Like, students are really thinking, if I get this computer science degree, then I just get to be a millionaire by the time I'm 30. Like, parents and families are just thinking about how much money people make with those degrees without thinking about the reality that the degree is just one step, right? Like, you have to have skills, you have to have experience, you have to have all kinds of other stuff that's really going to get you that higher salary. But people just robotically look at, doctor makes this much, so therefore, if my kid is a doctor, they get to make that much, right? And seriously, there is this like basic calculation that's going on in people's head. You don't see that in other countries where college is covered by the government, right? Like, in the Netherlands and other folks I met in Denmark, they're not thinking about it that way. They're thinking about what they want to do, the kind of life they want to live and stuff, the things that I encourage students to think about. In the United States, it's just, how much money will it cost to get the job that gives me that much money, right? And so people are not necessarily thinking about anthropology. So we've got a lot of drag going on. I've been going on for quite a while here, but in short, if you're looking to increase the number of archaeologists and archaeology training in the United States, you got to keep in mind the fact that there's a chance that you could have way fewer human beings to even go into that, and that a lot of people are making a very basic arithmetic for survival because universities are about to jack up tuition like higher than they've seen probably in their lives so far. And a lot of folks are making those calculations. Is it really going to pay off for me to go to a crumbling state school to get this degree in archaeology that, yeah, it prepares me for CRM, but I had to borrow $67,000 to do it? Like, people are really trying to make those kind of calculations. And so as we move forward in this podcast, I want folks to be cognizant of that. Like, these are the kind of things that are really going on in the United States that we should take into account when we talk about training the next generation of archaeologists.
Great. I think that's a good way to end this segment, and we'll see you in the next segment. Welcome back to CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 311. And we are talking about the future, the potential future of vocational training and technical workforce in CRM, part two. And Bill just like beautifully laid out in the first segment, just boy, the dire situation of
That was really good. Depressing, but really,
I guess I could put it in a nutshell that there is a lot of work in CRM and in archaeology compared to other fields like computer science, where it's just glutted and they don't, those jobs that were paying that much money all the time at Google and stuff, now they can take their pick of hundreds of thousands of people that are graduating every year. There's tens of thousands of people that finish with a computer science degree. So I don't know if that's going to go back to 500,000 for every single person and the like jungle gym at work and free food and stuff, because why, they don't have to. Every single school just cranked out 1 million computer science kids. So there's tons of those, but in our field, there's like very few. So maybe we should pull out the jungle gym and the free snacks at lunch and all the perpetual pizza parties, because you need to get people.
Oh, don't, so if don't do the perpetual pizza parties. That's got a really bad rap. Haven't you been watching the social media?
Yeah.
Okay. So some Jimmy John's, right? Chicken strips. All right. Some Dave's Hot Chicken, right?
We'll have like, those show parties. Show me the money.
Show me the chicken, right? Yeah. Show me the Dave's Hot. Yeah, but at any rate, if you're finishing an anthro and you want to do archaeology, you have a better chance than I've seen to actually get a career in archaeology.
Okay, but so let's stop right there.
Yeah.
Yes, that's promising. However, just like those computer science degrees, which now are a dime a dozen, you now have to prove that you have the skills. So this isn't just getting the degree. Let's talk about what that means. That doesn't mean that you get the degree, your job is done. It has just begun. Bill?
Yeah, you're right. That. Yes. This one is the future of vocational training in CRM. As long as we've been having a podcast, as long as I've ever been around, it was field school. Field school was the thing that, like, I went to an undergrad program that had, it was a true four-field school, but all of us had an applied class that we had to take. If you were a linguistics specialist in my anthro program, you took a 6-week lab unit or a summer course or something that met your linguistics criteria, and then you could finish and then you got your anthro degree, but you had a specialty in linguistics, right? Same thing with cultural anthropology, physical, and archaeology. And when it came to archaeology, 6-credit field school with an accredited university was required to finish my bachelor's at Boise State. I don't know if things have changed, but that's just how our department was. And it was just assumed back then in the 90s, in the 1900s, that you would just take a field school and pay the tuition and get this, and you weren't going to get paid for it. And you were just going to get the credits, and that's what you got for your diploma. But dude, stuff has changed, man. It is not cheap to live in Boise, Idaho anymore. And asking a bunch of people to take classes, like I just said, that are thousands of dollars anywhere in the world, or even the one offered by the university, which sadly, if you're a BSU student, please send us a message, because I haven't paid attention to my own department. Sorry, I've just been watching the football team, but not watching the anthro department. But I don't know if they have a field school, but I know that tuition is not what it was in the 1900s. And so when you're asking students all this stuff, like they're thinking in their mind, does it pay off for me to do field school? If you want to do archaeology, that's like a rite of passage. But like, we're seriously asking people to take out a few thousand dollars in debt and then pray that they can just put all their stuff up in their parents' house for the summer or have their roommates cover the apartment for 3 or 6 weeks. It's just, it's a bigger ask than it was in the 1900s. And so it's harder for students to do that. So then the question is, how do we teach those workforce skills in the classroom? And as someone who works at a university, I'm sorry to say that, like, without CRM putting the money in to build the program, it is very difficult. If you wanted to do some kind of CRM certification or a technical certification or something like that, like, you'd have to put together several faculty who are going to teach the classes. Now, if you work at a functional school, not the one I work at, you could find some colleagues who would put their minds together and do something like that. Then you'd have that certificate. Now, the question is, does that teach what CRM wants? Hopefully, CRM folks would be part of building it so that then folks did walk out with actual skills that were put together in concert with people in the industry. But we could build a certification program. Now, if you wanted a master's program, that's a bigger lift, right? If you want a master's program, first, your university is going to ask you to do an audit of whether you have the professors and the mentorship to even do it. And the second thing they're going to do is, how many students do you have enrolled for it to make money? That will be the university's straight up equation. So as someone who's at the department, you'd have to go through and talk to all your colleagues and say, what's your mentorship load? Like, can you take on more master students? Do we have space for it? And then based on our enrollments, how big would we have to increase this for the university to issue you the privilege to make a master's degree? Because once again, they want to know that you're going to get enrollment to cover, I don't know, more for the football team, like all the legal aid that we're constantly being sued every month. Like, I don't know what they're doing with all that money, but I do know that they're going to ask you, does this make financial sense for the university? And it might not, man. If you work in a small department that only has a few dozen anthro enrollments, and they say that it would take 20 something master students to break even or make money for the university, where are you going to get additional students? You got to start advertising and figure it out. Like, how are you going to do that? It ain't going to be easy. So at the university, just like CRM, cash is the equation that they're constantly looking at. And so that's what professors have to come up with and CRM has to come up with to convince the university to issue that piece of paper.
Man, I'm glad I work at a community college now. Because I started my own program basically just with my own chutzpah and moxie, friends. Bill, you bring up so much stuff. Oh, there's so much here. In, I guess, a very large nutshell, I would say that in terms of the cost of the degrees, it's become a religion, sadly, what I would say. And what I mean by that is the parents all believe this religion that, like, my kid needs to get into the very expensive school. I've seen this because I have a daughter in high school. And I see all the parents talking and they get all a titter and excited when they hear that, hey, this year you can go to Columbia for only 60 grand a year, yeah, this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And it's you idiots. I sit there and I'm just like, you fools. Yeah, and what's funny is my daughter has two college professor parents and we're the ones who are the most relaxed. We're like, go to a state school. Don't spend too much money.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
We're the ones who say that. But all the other parents who aren't in college world, they believe in a religion. It's a religious belief because it has nothing to do with reality. It has nothing to do with facts. It has to do with a belief in it's magical thinking.
It's also a lack of experience in higher ed, though, too.
That's true, and too.
But people need to understand that, yes, there's these big names that in some instances that does get you more money. It does give you more prestige in some very specific careers. But in archaeology, you could have the best archaeological program, right? That there's some great ones in California that are not prestigious schools. Parents need to look at what do their kids want to go into and then look for the good schools that the people that are going to hire their kid, what schools, what programs have the greatest respect and are churning out good professionals.
Yeah, that they're 1,000 miles away from that, sadly. And they won't hear it, though, even when you tell them, because I told people this for decades and I sit them down and they literally don't hear what I'm saying. Yeah. They think I'm full of it. They think I just don't know.
And to make it even more complex, in archaeology, you have the academic prestige and then you have the CRM prestige.
Right.
So you could go and get a degree, a graduate degree, a PhD in academia and have a lot of prestige in academia if you're going to go that route. But it has nothing in CRM. It really doesn't. In fact, it can hurt you. If you get a degree in a prestigious academic archaeology program, a CRM company will look at that and say, you know what? You are not going to be valuable to me because you're going to get in the weeds on everything. Yeah.
And in those prestigious academic programs, they poo-poo CRM. They don't even teach it. They don't even know it. They're totally ignorant. And they go, we don't do that here. You know, you don't have to worry about that.
I think there's just a couple things going on. Like our relationship to education in the United States is changing and we haven't really dealt with that as a country. I think that higher education's like role and the way that it works is also changing in the United States. And then finally, the prestige factor and the way that people have thought about higher ed and the role it plays in our lives, all of that stuff has changed. And when we're talking about building vocational training in universities, though, I have been an advocate, I don't even know how many years, but this is what I was advocating in my SAA speech. is the industry has to actually partner with universities. Like, the time is now over. It's fully over expecting me and other professors to train anyone. Like, that, that ship, if that ever was here, has fully sailed. Like, yes. You're at a situation where you might not have enough human beings that are capable of digging a shovel probe, like even going to school anymore. And if CRM does not step up with an actual checkbook and make this thing happen, it will not happen. It will not happen. This is this today, the 18th of May, whatever, 2025, this is the peak of humans of the age group that can walk in the desert for 10 hour days. Like, this is it. So if there isn't ACRA task force, if there's not some kind of money that's set aside to create endowments for professors to work at universities with their sole job is to train people for CRM. If CRM folks, the PhDs and the MA folks, don't start teaching and zooming into hybrid Zoom into classes, right? If they don't just build it straight up, find the universities that are willing, because there are half a dozen universities out there that already teach CRM master's programs and stuff. And then there's a bunch of schools, state schools, the ones that I told you that the axe is going to come down financially on them. They love to have 20,000, 80,000, 100,000 for $1 million. You could take a school like Boise State and just basically build an entire CRM program. And that would take $100,000 from the top 10 firms in the United States to just puppet a university. So I'm just saying, like, these are the kind of things that ACRA needs to be, rather than focusing on what will be taught, the role of field school, all this other stuff. If they don't actually just create programs, there's just not going to be any CRM archaeologists.
Okay, so I have a question for you.
Sure.
And Andrew.
How much? I will do it for $100,000.
So I'll be 98. My question
go
is...
Go with Andrew.
From a CRM perspective, if CRM companies are going to do this, there's going to have to be some assurance that the people that are teaching these classes are going to be able to actually churn out valuable students.
Then take your PhDs that are PIs at your company and give them a leave of absence for a year to work at a university as an instructor of record.
Bill, I'm telling you, there are some companies that focus on PhDs. Okay. We have one right now.
Yeah.
I am not inclined to hire PhDs. There's very few of them that can actually do the job.
But universities are not inclined to hire people who don't have a PhD. So you can get some skilled MA folks, find the right school for you. Find the one in your state or your area that'll do it.
So you mean that'll hire an MA to teach those classes?
Yeah. If you come up with a check and say, I'll pay all their benefits and wages and everything, all they do is get to teach three classes a year.
That's my question. So that is my question, whether or not that the system will allow that. It's going to have to. And in fact, money talks,
for money,
right?
I was going to say, for money, university will do anything.
And okay. I'll tell you, so you look at ROTC, one example, right? So the ROTC programs, right? They have to have military science degrees. That's how the ROTC program works. And so they have degreed military individuals that are professors, military science professors, and most of the time they do not have PhDs. So it is possible.
Well, and not only that, but in the United States, our land grant schools were set aside as the technical, agricultural, and military universities of those states. So in California, it's UC Berkeley. In Idaho, it's the University of Idaho. In Arizona, it's the University of Arizona. Those land grant schools. So they already have a contract with the state to provide those services anyway. And a lot of times they will have ag and military science things. So this goes into the technical training. The land grant schools would be your first pick. Oregon, Washington, right? Texas at Austin. Those would be the ones that you would aim at first because that's part of their charter to teach technical skills. So the key reason for that is, like, structurally that organization or that university is set up to allow this kind of thing to happen. A pure research institute like Harvard or Cornell or Yale, they're not necessarily set up to have like technical training. So their entire organization doesn't really have a way for cash to necessarily go that way. They have it for research. I guess you could use that pathway, but I'm just saying, if you wanted to do something in forestry and you wanted to aim at the University of California, Berkeley, that's the land grant school. Like, from its charter, it already has a pathway. It'll already have grant administrators that are familiar with that legal domain. That's what I'm saying. Like, structurally, those schools are set up for that. And that's the sad thing in California about the state schools, because a lot of those were set up vocationally like that. So those ones were set up to have this same kind of thing that I'm talking about. And those are the ones that are suffering budgetarily. So, you know, I'm just saying our country is already designed for this. Medicine is a perfect example. Tech is a perfect example. Business schools, perfect example of how just industry can just go in and just aim a university in a certain direction using cash.
Okay. All right. Great. This is great. All right. We'll see you on the other side. Segment 3. Welcome back to CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 311. We are talking about the potential future of vocational training and technical workforce in CRM. Oh my goodness. I almost want to change the name of this podcast to Must Listen. So everybody listens. This is such a great primer.
Yeah.
And I think we could do a part 3 and a part 4. This actually ties into so many different aspects or so many different subjects that we've talked about over the last 10 years. And it actually brings it to, I don't know, like a realness. And so during the break, we started talking. I'm like, you know what? Let's stop. Bill has reached out to local CRM companies and has said, you know, I know that Andrew has done the same thing more so from because you have, and Bill has the CRM background too, but your program has been this way since you started it.
Yeah.
And I know you still talk to CRM companies, but to me, and it evolves. What CRM companies need do evolve. And so it's important to stay in contact.
Yeah.
But we are talking about how these universities and what you guys are doing is everything right about what and what needs to happen in these other programs. And that is reaching out to the CRM companies, finding out what it is that is lacking in students that they're seeing come in, and then constantly evolving the curriculum to make sure that these students are better prepared. However, I do want to talk about that. And we just touched on this in the first segment. So for those students that are out there and you're looking into a graduate program, please remember that these classes that you're getting are wetting your whistle. These are just giving you an idea of what you need to do. They're emphasizing and they are teaching you and they're giving you a good primer on what you need skill-wise in CRM. But they don't mean you know everything. And I know that seems so rudimentary. That seems so rudimentary. Everybody should know that. But it does not mean that, okay, you know what? I took classes from Andrew Kinkella. I took classes from Bill White. And they're on the front lines of making sure that archaeology students know what it takes to be successful in CRM. And you can be primed with the best of the best when it comes to CRM professors. And I will say that my two co-hosts are definitely that. But that does not mean that you.
Yeah, I was going to say.
But it's true. And you guys are being humble. That is not to say that you could be tremendously skilled or tremendous. You could have tremendous promise and you could have been trained by the best. But that does not mean that you're going to walk in and you're going to demand these high paying positions. Yeah. First of all, yes, you can make a decent living in archaeology, but that still isn't the same living that you can make in medicine. But you can make a decent living at it, but that takes a long time to get there. So please, even though I think it should be really obvious, you are not going to walk into CRM and be making buku bucks.
Yeah. And another thing, too, I want to add is that I don't think that university programs should orient themselves 100% towards providing vocational skills for students. Right. There does need to be a research emphasis at many schools. There does need to be people who do go to other countries where they don't have the same kind of funding for archaeology and do archaeology. Right. And it doesn't have to all be paid, as you were all talking about, vocational, retirees, volunteers and stuff. There's got to be space for all of those folks. So I'm not saying that everything needs to be like Shovel Probe 100, Shovel Probe 103. Now I'm at graduate level shovel probes like those. I don't think that we need to make every single class like that. But I do think that what would make you successful in CRM would make you successful in all kinds of archaeology. And so I do think that there should be a little bit more emphasis on that at programs that are willing. Now, the elephant in the room is actual faculty, because we're not normal. If you don't know a professor, we're not normal. And then you put 12 of us in a room together and it's like the deformed animals at the zoo all in one cage, right? We're not the normal ones, right?
I'm misfit toys.
Yeah, exactly. The island, totally. So yeah, all these misfit toys, trying to get that to do what you want is not going to be easy. Mm-hmm. Even with cash, it's not going to be easy. So that's why I think that there's certain schools, right? There's Andrew, and I don't know if your whole department is this way, but I'm just the outcast that's doing this stuff. The other people are doing their own thing, where you're going to be excellent at geomorphology if you take this professor. You're going to be super skilled in remote sensing if you take this. That's the beauty of an anthro department. There's super skilled people that can teach you better than anyone else. That's how they got to be a professor. I'm just saying, tweak it a little so that it's more amenable to careers, because by just tweaking it a little there will be it'll be able to be applicable in all different aspects of archaeology, not just CRM.
Yeah, I'm very lucky in terms of my department. I really am living the dream where there's three part-timers and we all kind of support each other. But it's because we all have our own fiefdoms. I am the archaeology guy. And the other person is the bio person. And the other person is the cultural person. So when it comes to money and the behind the scenes stuff, we're very mutually supportive, because it only helps us.
You know? Yeah, so, bigger schools, that's not how it is, man. So that's why, once again, CRM should pick its institution wisely. It should look for an accredited school. I already mentioned state schools, right? Those are good, because a lot of those were oriented towards professional skills and training. Or a land grant school, right? Because they're structurally designed to have those kind of technical schools. Those are places that would be good choices right away for CRM, because they're set up that way. But then you need to look departmentally, right? Because there's a total habit in bigger anthro departments to have this Pokemon strategy where you have a card of everyone. We've got an archaeologist that specializes in just the coal furnaces of West Virginia. We've got another one that specializes in just the ceremonial sanctuaries on this one island of Greece. We've got this other person. And so rather than having three people who are good at Greek archaeology so that you could just be the department, if you don't go there, you're not going to go anywhere. It's like we've got a person. And so then that person is supposed to build their own tiny fiefdom in a corner and not articulate with others. And when it comes to resources, argue against others in their own department for their own, for students, for space, for money, for attention of the dean, all this different stuff, right? So once again, CRM might want to think about those departments. Which ones are all the misfit toys trying to hurt each other? Don't go there, because that is not going to be an easy place to start what you're trying to do.
And what makes it worse too, is it changes over time. It depends on who the new guy is and who retired and all that stuff. So there's all these dynamics. I think in California, a large state school would probably be the best spot to drop this program.
Yeah. I think here's the other thing I'd like to just talk about for a little bit is, I agree with you. We do need researchers, because what CRM does is we have to come in, we have to get the answers, we have to look at the regulatory side of things. There are some things that we specialize in, and because much of it is not research. And so we will always in archaeology need researchers, because they're the ones that can really dive in and focus on whatever you said, the coal fire or whatever, coal furnace or whatever. Yeah.
I don't know anyone who specializes in that. So that's a research niche. So anybody out there listening, you could be the guru of coal furnaces.
Right. But we do need those people, because we can't do that as CRM professionals. Right. There's no way we can do that. So we need to lean on the people that have focused on that area, and we can use their literature, that when we do come across a coal furnace, that they're the ones that we can reach out to, or we at least have the literature that we can study. So the researchers will always be very important. We need that, because we don't have the time to do that. We can't dive deep and we don't have the time for it. There'll always be room for that. But I think that students misunderstand that when they go into a program and then they go, even geomorphology, let's say geoarchaeology, that's becoming a bigger and bigger thing. So I'm saying that with SHPOs are requiring an actual geoarchaeologist to come in and do that part of the work for your study that you're doing for a project. And so people are getting the misunderstanding that you can go and just specialize in geoarchaeology and all CRM companies are going to hire you just as a geoarchaeologist. Right, I've got news for you. And I know there's a few, I have friends on LinkedIn that are geoarchaeologists. And if they're listening to this, they're not going to be happy, but you have to have other skill sets. You have to have other skill sets because there are some companies I can think off the top of my head that can have just a geoarchaeologist and they're going to focus just on that aspect for all the studies for the company. But most CRM companies are not like that. So you have to be, you cannot be a one-trick pony. You cannot say, I'm just going to be the expert in just geophysics and just do the ground penetrating radar. Mm-hmm. You have to be a multi-trick pony in CRM or you're not going to get a job or you're not going to move up in the ranks easily. Because the last thing you want to be, that's the other thing for the culture in CRM, the last thing you want to be is the person who ends up being the geoarchaeologist and that's all you do. Because I'm telling you, you're not going to, you are not going to generate revenue. Therefore, you're not going to move up the ranks. You're not going to make more money. That is, people can complain about it all they want. And it's funny because Doug, we had a little discussion and he was like, people need to start looking at archaeology like professional athletes. And I've got news for you. Professional athletes are paid the way they're paid because they bring in revenue. Yeah. And that's the way business is looked at. And if you're not the one bringing in the revenue, which means I'm talking about you're not bringing in the money, you're not bringing in the projects and clients that bring in a lot of money, you're not going to be successful in CRM money-wise. You may be successful in respect and people will say you're the go-to, but you're not going to make it. That's just not what generates who gets paid what.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm glad you said that. And one of the things I try to do in my classes, I have a lab where I have some students and I only try to hire work studies or people who want to do undergrad theses because I don't believe that students should be doing extra labor for free. But there's a couple of graduate students, they really do their own pathway. But one of the things that we do is look at grant opportunities that we could go for and look at our capacity in the lab. Can we actually, in fact, do that? And if that's not going to be your PhD, do you really have multiple years to focus on that? Because we have meetings where we look at the proposals and should we go for this? I have the students help with the research design and I have students help write the budget and stuff. They look at like how much they're getting paid as their position, like the unionized graduate students, they look and see like how much money could this budget handle for them to actually do it? Or is it better for them to get their own scholarship some other way and then have the undergraduates do the work? Can they get paid? How much do we pay the other people in the community that we're working with? The health and safety plan, like they walk through all the steps that we have to do to file this project with the university. They help fill out the form, like where is the hospital? So we work through that. They work through the research design, like what are the research questions we think we can answer given the site? Like what would we have to do to find that evidence? So everybody in the lab, the undergrad and the graduates, they're working on the proposal. And then when the stuff comes through, they work on the field work. And then they also work on reporting the project. And it's slow because we work at a university. It's nowhere close to CRM. But in that process, like everybody gets to divide up whether they want to focus on a button or whether they want to focus on this and that. And think about how many hours per day do you have to even contribute to this? And like, how can we get this all done by May? And what can we do? And so in that process, they do see, okay, there's a thing that's available, but it's only available for professors of this level. And it's really dedicated to this. So how do we write a proposal so we can get the money? Then who in the lab is going to get this money? And then what are we going to do? Do we have existing data that we can build off of? And so each round of students is really building the grant for the next students to come through. And then they do the same thing because a lot of times these come to fruition like after they've graduated, but it wouldn't have gotten there if they didn't already have those skills, if they hadn't already done the research. And so I help them through the whole process. And if they need professors to sign off on it, and then I make sure that they have space to work and all the tools that they need. But I contribute, I don't write the whole report, right? Like I'm out there on the field work, they're doing the field work. It's like a CRM project basically, but it's through a university. And I found that kind of experiential stuff does like way more than any field school or anything I could teach in a class. And that's the kind of thing that I think that CRM can really help. Because what if I didn't have to do all the other gibberish that I have to for my university? What if I was just an endowed person that just only did this with students? Like I have 4 or 5 now, I could have 10 or 15 if 40 hours a week I was just only doing that. And that's what I'm saying, where, you know, you can really either amplify an existing professor who's doing that. You can hire someone who does the like project management so that the professors can just do the field work and the reporting. There's a lot of different ways that this can go, that CRM can help out universities if it decides to. But I mean, I am telling you now, like today's the day, like this is the year 2025. If it doesn't happen now, it ain't going
to
happen.
Yeah. You know, it's funny just listening to Bill, that like what I teach has evolved so similar to what he has. Like independently, we come towards the same oracle. I will say, as I was listening, I would slightly defend old school field schools just for a couple of reasons. Reason number one is that speed. Bill just talked about when you're in academia, there's a slow, you can go slow. You have the ability to go slow. If you're on an old school field school, you go out to Greece or you go out to Belize or wherever, there is, you do get a feeling for the speed. You have to go at real speed. And that's nice for students to have, even though you're not, maybe the skill set isn't as good as getting it through CRM. It still gives you a feeling of that. And the cost, which, yeah, maybe it's $2,000 or $3,000 to go on a field school. But if you're paying $80,000 at Dartmouth, it's chump change. So I still feel that cost for a field school, especially if it's not too bad, is worth it in the long run for that extra experience.
Yeah.
Add the field school onto what I'm talking about, and you've got someone who's like ready to go. They're crew chief ready.
Exactly.
Yeah. And they'll also, a master's won't be hard for a student like that, because they've already written several technical report sections. They've already done some artifact analysis. That person over 2 years, they've gotten a taste of all those things. When they go for their master's, it's going to be that much easier. And then when you get someone who's done that plus field school plus a master's, you've got someone that you really, it's worth paying to keep that person. They're super good.
I think, boy, we can't talk about this now because we're already over time, but I think the one thing I would just leave, and maybe this is a part three, but really looking at what it would take. I know you've thrown out some numbers, but there's no way CRM companies alone are going to be able to go to their local universities and fork over the money that it takes to build the program. There's got to be some really creative ways of doing this, because unless CRM companies come together, and so that's going to be another feat in and of itself, but the margins are not that high. We eat ourselves, because in order for people to be competitive, the margins are not high. And people need to understand that. But students that are coming into the workforce, like, they think that these big engineering firms and everybody has all this money and they're making all this money on the backs of, I'm telling you, as a managing principal, that doesn't, in CRM, that does not, it doesn't work that way. That we are, can, so people say, oh, you have an engineering firm, they have a lot of money, they're making a lot of money on the civil side of things. But that, it does not work that way. Each practice needs to be viable and needs to generate revenue that makes sense for the company to keep them on. And the revenue for CRM, in order to be competitive, but at the same time be valuable to a company, it is a fine line, and the profit margin is not large. So just being able to drop money into universities, unless CRM companies are coming together to do that, is not going to happen. Organization like ACRA could definitely help with that.
Yeah.
But they've got to focus on it.
I think there's ways that we can do it too. We're out of time, but like the first way would be for CRM people to reach out to universities and look at the syllabi of what people are teaching in class, and then know, okay, this one's passed our muster. If someone does this course, that course, and this course from these 5 professors, then that's helped them with this, that, and this. That's the easiest way. The second way could be for people in CRM to teach as guest lecturers during summer courses. You can make them hybrid or you can make them online. They would be content to that person, but it'd have to be like intro to archaeology, but it would still just be focused on CRM. And so that you'd be able to get people that way. Or you could, and in that case, like someone's getting paid as an adjunct and they're a CRM person to build this hybrid or online class, right? So once again, you got to find the right institution, have the credentials, get it on the books, work with the curriculum folks and get it in there. So that's another pathway, that you could just get your own CRM classes in a university that students will take. And summer's the easiest one of all to get in there because folks, they want to take classes over the summer to help speed up things during the semester. And so we're more flexible on summer classes as long as you meet the criteria. And then, of course, like internships, which we've covered several different times before. And once again, I'll talk more about that, but that's also a pathway. So those three things right there, like the university still burdening most of the cost, but CRM is finding a way to get into universities to teach the skills. And you can move from there wherever you want, right?
Yeah.
You know, ACRA can get together, California Archaeology, Northwestern Anthropological, they can get together, different regional groups, SEAC, they can decide to go together, but look at different institutions, do the same thing, and decide as an organization what counts. There's other things we could do regionally that doesn't have to involve like hundreds of thousands. If you did get to the point where you just endowed people and then placed them in departments, if you could get them in there, right? Like that'd be the ultimate, because then you'd have basically a training institute in that school that's like partially public-private funded, right?
Great. This has been a great discussion. Bill, thank you so much for imparting your knowledge. You know, we'll be putting some links in addition to what Bill's already put in, but we'll be putting a few more links in there if you're interested in delving into this. Bill and Andrew have been working on the front lines of this effort for many years. And then Bill also has been a studier with the work that you've been doing with
Airlie House people. Right? Yeah.
So there's just some great, there's some great resources out there that you can really get an understanding. And I think it's useful for new students and for all the way to learned or highly experienced professionals and learn a lot.
That's it for another episode of the CRM Archaeology Podcast. Links to some of the items mentioned on the show are in the show notes for this podcast, which can be found at www.arcpodnet.com/CRM Arc Podcast. Please comment and share anywhere you see the show. If you'd like us to answer a question in a future episode, email us. Use the contact form on the website or just email chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Support the show and the network at arcpodnet.com/members. Get some swag and extra content while you're there. Send us show suggestions and interview suggestions. We want this to be a resource for field technicians everywhere, and we want to know what you want to know about.
All right. Thanks, everyone, for joining us, and we'll see you in the field. Goodbye.
Thanks. Bye.
See you guys next time.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht, and our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.